So practicing with equanimity on the fourth day of this retreat. So as promised at the beginning of the retreat, we're exploring equanimity in many different ways. There are many different ways that it shows up. As mentioned before, there are 10 ways that it shows up in on the Buddhist lists, in different facets. And in a way, the way to think of that is, you know, the crown jewel of practice, if we think of equanimity as a jewel, as a diamond, as light falls on this diamond, there are different facets you see that fall, different colors come out, there are different aspects, but it's still the same practice, it's the same aspect, but there are different ways to relate to it. Yesterday afternoon, we heard from Gil beautifully about how it functions as one of the factors of awakening. The day before, I spoke about how it's a Brahmavihara, how it can function as a practice, as a cultivation practice, which is a little different from a factor, from an awakening factor. It's kind of the attitudinal. It's still similar. You see the evenness of mind is still there. This quality is there, but it functions a little differently in the cultivation and in the relational practices and as a factor. And in fact, I also want to bring in that not only there are so many different ways that in Buddhism on different lists, equanimity shows up in different ways to relate to it and really open ourselves to that. It's not just one way. I also wanted to bring in that, as I mentioned the first night, equanimity is also a very important virtue that's advocated by many religions and ancient philosophies. Hinduism, yoga, Judaism, Christianity, Baha'ism, the Baha'i faith. I mentioned yoga, yes. Romans and Greeks extol the virtues of equanimity. And one that was actually particularly interesting for me was reading about how the concept of equanimity shows up in Islam, which was the religion of my birth. And there are many things I knew growing up in a liberal Muslim family about Islam, but this one was interesting to me. So I'll share it with you, and you'll see this other way, another tradition relates to this concept of equanimity in such a fundamental way. And that is, so the word Islam is derived from the Arabic word aslama, which denotes the peace that comes from total surrender and acceptance. You're with me so far? Sounds like equanimity? Okay. So a true Muslim would experientially behold that everything happening is meant to be and stems from the ultimate wisdom of God. Hence, being a Muslim can therefore be understood to mean that one is in a state of equanimity. So being a Muslim means you're equanimous with whatever arises because it is the will of Allah. So you trust the wisdom of Allah. So there's equanimity with whatever arises. Another way to arrive at equanimity, yes, same concept, a different way, beautiful way, different. And yet I want to highlight this idea of equanimity as universal. So speaking of these different facets of equanimity and different ways to relate to it and understand it and experience it in our practice here on this retreat on the cushion, what I'd like to speak about today is equanimity as a jhanic factor. So that statement actually is going to require a lot of definition in the moment, especially for those who are new to practice. What is a jhanic factor? Okay, so before I get into the meat of the talk today, I want to give a disclaimer of sorts. And that is, parts of this talk at the beginning, I need to define a lot of different terminology to get to the jhanic factors and why equanimity relates. So part of this may not be directly that the as with the definition may not feel directly relevant to the moment-to-moment practice you're doing, yet understanding the more about the path, about this tradition, about the practices, I hope will enrich your practice, and there will be nuggets which will support you. And by the time I'll bring in the concept of equanimity and how it supports, you'll see how all of it fits together. So, and for some of you, as I'm setting up the structures and I'm talking about concentration and the jhanic factors and samatha and vipassana and all of that, you've heard these concepts before. As I'm setting the ground for the newer people, I invite you not to check out. I invite you to listen with a beginner's mind, as if you haven't heard them before, and see how they might land differently, how they might actually open up something new and different in your practice. Because sometimes the tendency that the non-beginner's mind is that, oh yeah, I've heard that. Oh yeah, yeah, same old, same old. Actually not hearing the nuances, not hearing the way in which it might be a little different. It might be opening another door, another Dharma gate for you. So I invite you to have a beginner's mind, which has lots of possibilities. It's open. The expert's mind is closed. It doesn't. It knows it all. It doesn't even have to listen to anything or anybody. It knows it all. So I invite a beginner's mind. May we all continuously always have a beginner's mind towards our life and practice. So speaking a bit about the jhanic factors. So jhanic factors, I'll say a little bit and I'll get into the more details. So the jhanic factors are the factors of mind, mental factors, that arise when one is practicing with states of samatha, states of concentration, states of unification of mind. Either in access concentration or states of jhana. Okay. And I will define that sentence in a moment, all of the various things that I said. Okay. First, let me define, even though we've talked about it already, let me just say a little more about samatha, about concentration practice. So, two of the primary practices in this tradition are samatha and vipassana. And vipassana, insight practice, is how it's translated as insight, seeing deeply, seeing into the nature of things, seeing things the way they are. And that's the primary practice we're doing here, insight practice. Samatha practice, often translated as concentration, which is a very poor translation. I'm completely on board, on the same page with Gil, as he mentioned that yesterday, that it does tend to, in our Western culture, bring up a sense of tightness for most people. So the word itself It's derived from the Pali prefix sam, which means together, and the root da, which means to put, to place. To put together, to place together, to bring together. So unify, bring together, unification, composure, composed, gathering, collectedness, non-distractedness, stabilizing, calming, steady, malleable. These are some of the synonyms for the practice, for samatha practice. So primarily I'm going to use the word samatha itself. Samadhi is the state, samatha is the practice. So I'll use the word samadhi for and samatha and unification. And now that I might drop in concentration here, but I hope you don't get tightened up, like try to concentrate, you know, right? Whereas the invitation is unification. So we have invited you, actually, to calm the mind, to stabilize the mind, to settle the mind, to unify the mind, not primarily for its own purpose, but to do that in order to cultivate equanimity, in order to cultivate insight, in order to see things as they are. So on a 7-day insight practice, we do spend usually the first couple of days by inviting you to be with the body and the breath. In a way, it is an invocation of samatha practice. But we don't stay there. We don't stay the rest of the time. We open up to emotions, to thoughts, with our instructions, to see things arising and passing away in this retreat, in the state of equanimity. Okay. If this was a samatha retreat, samadhi retreat, we would be just staying with the same object, with the breath or the body or whatever object, for the entire time, not moving, not opening up to others. So one way to understand, to relate to the difference, and this question comes up a lot. What is the difference between samatha practice and vipassana practice? I heard from Steve Armstrong many years ago this hard to forget simile. So he likened vipassana when, you know, you stabilize the mind and then you open up and then you're with one object and you're really committed to it. You're not distracted. You're really committed to one object, the body, and then maybe you move to a sound. You're really committed to the sound. You're not distracted, really, with the sound, and then moving to another object, perhaps. So moving from object to object with commitment, not wavering, as serial monogamy. Comparing that to samatha practice, where you're with one object, say with your breath, or with the sensations of the body, or the Brahmaviharas, metta practice, for example. With one object, you're just with that. You don't move at all. When thoughts come, you say, oh, thank you. Not adversarial, but you come back to the same. You don't open up to work with the thoughts and see them arising and passing and seeing their impermanent nature and seeing their emptiness, etc. You just say, no, thank you, not now. You just come back to your object, the breath, for example. So that's likened to absolute monogamy. You are with one object, you're not moving at all, with one object alone. So that's one way to think about these two practices differ. And yet, as I've said, the samatha practice, unification practice, we do a little bit of that to calm the mind, to unify the mind, to make it malleable so that it is available for vipassana. Otherwise, the mind will be unstable and all over the place. Tends to be. There's some practices where, anyway, I won't get into all the exceptions. So samatha and vipassana practice. Okay, so samatha unification of mind. So just to say, also, as I referred to, there are many, many objects for samatha, for unifying the mind. We offer the breath as a way to collect and calm and unify the mind as the anchor. You might have heard that terminology as the anchor. But that is one of 40 different objects. There are 40 different objects for practicing samatha. The Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, lists them all. There are, for example, the Brahma Viharas that I spoke about a couple of days ago, the practices of the heart, metta, loving kindness, compassion, and vicarious joy, and upekkha, equanimity practice. These are two objects, the objects of samatha practice. So you can actually, when I was sharing with you that I did a month of Brahma Vihara practices, I was practicing Brahma Vihara jhanas, and I was very, very happy for a month. So those, as you repeat, may I be safe, or may you be safe, the different people you're practicing, mind gets, they can get very, very, very collected and unified and get absorbed. Absorption can arise into access concentration, first, second, third jhana. Not fourth with the metta. I'll say more about it in a moment. But so doing these practices can actually really settle the mind and heart. Some other objects, just to put that on your radar, to know the expansiveness of possibilities of this practice. There are many casinos, and casinos are thought as things that one can behold directly. That's kind of the translation, which is a funny translation, or whole. So let me give some examples. There are some color casinos. So one can have a color as an object of unifying the mind, bringing the mind back to a color, to color white, yellow, red, etc. Bunch of colors. There's the earth casino, water. So bringing to the concept of water, and the way this could be practiced is, you, for example, look at earth. If you're doing the earth casino practice, you get an image, the concept of earth, so that when you close your eyes, it's always there. So the mind comes back to that, and absorption can arise. And many other objects. So some of these, some of the 40 objects can only support the mind to the level of access concentration, upachara samadhi, which I'll define more deeply, but it's a level of samatha, which is before absorption. And then some of them, the mind can go more deeply into different levels of jhana. So with anapanasati, which is either here or in the body, basically mindfulness of the breath, one can practice all four jhanas and access concentration and the four jhanas. And similarly with all the kasinas, with all the colors and all the various earth, fire, water, and air. But for example, with Brahma Viharas that I mentioned, loving kindness, compassion, and vicarious joy, the first three, one can experience only access concentration up to third jhana, and not the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana can only be experienced with equanimity practice of the Brahma Viharas. The reason is, as I'll get into, it's a little backwards, but you'll see in a moment, the first three jhanas have so much, they're so energetic in terms of joy and bliss, that, and also the both metta and mudita and karuna also have so much activity in them that the mind cannot get into the equanimity of the fourth jhana, which is much more equanimous. So I'm explaining this a little out of hand, out of order. I'll come to it. If you're wondering what she's talking about, give me a moment. It's setting all the structures. Okay. So, let me talk about, let me talk about the jhanic factors. I think that makes sense to talk about jhanic factors next and then talk about the jhanas, really define them in terms of the jhanic factors. Okay. This, I feel like I'm building, like, little by little. I hope you're with me, especially the newer people. So with the jhanic factors, there are five jhanic factors. So actually, let me take a step back and define, it will get kind of related to each other. So access concentration, or upachara samadhi, which is a state that arises when the mind is really calm, stable, undistracted, bright. It arises before the mind can enter into absorption. And what does the word absorption mean? Absorption, which is the case for, so upachara samadhi is not an absorption, the state of undistractedness, but it's not an absorption. Jhanas 1 through 4, and then there are also jhanas 5 through 8. There are 8 jhanas total, which I will not talk about today. But please know they're there. But the first 4 jhanas, in terms of depth, so the 4 jhanas, the 8 jhanas, are states of absorption. So what does absorption mean? So absorption means that the mind, when it keeps coming back to the same object over and over again, with this unification, at some point really feels a sense of unification and merging with the object, as if the mind is merging with the object of its attention, awareness, and affection by that point. So if, say, the practitioner is practicing mindfulness of the breath, anapanasati, there can be a sense of merging, that the breath is completely breathing you, and there's no separation between you and the breath, and the breath just, being absorbed into the breath, or with the, say, color kasinas, being absorbed into the color white. So it's hard to describe some of these, so words fail, but please just, I hope with your equanimity, there's no frustration arising, like, what the heck does this mean if it's not accessible? Just file it on the side, let it be a seed that maybe will inspire you for your practice at some point. Which I'm going to take a pause actually for a moment and say, my hope and intention in offering this talk today and laying the territory is to bring up inspiration and aspiration, not expectation. Expectation is very tight, is frustrating. I want this. This sounds good. I need to have it. Why is it not happening for me on this retreat or next retreat? Can actually really hinder your deepening, your humanity, your progress. in this path of awakening. And it's not about getting. This path is not about getting. It's about letting go. The story of this well-respected monk, after I think having been a monk for decades, he says at the beginning of a talk, provocatively, that I've been a monk for decades, I haven't got anything out of it. And people are shocked. Oh, is he going to disrobe? What's going to happen? And he talks about, but I've let go of a lot. I've let go of a lot. So please keep that in mind. It's about letting go. It's not about attaining these attainments. It's not about that. It's about letting go. And it's about, so the aspiration to say, this aspiration is uplifting. May I wake up? May I let go? I do the practice. I put the supportive conditions in place. And with my aspiration being waking up, it will do me in the ways that I need to be done in my life on this path later. So that is my hope. Inspiration, aspiration, not expectation, not the feeling of tightness. Just knowing that there is a lot more to this practice, more tools that could be available if your mind is inclined in these various ways. So, okay, so coming back to defining, so I've defined what an absorption is to the best of my ability as the words can allow. You can get a sense of it, perhaps. So now let me define the jhanic factors, what the jhanic factors are, and then how the jhanas, the four jhanas, and the how the four jhanas and jhanic factors interplay, and ta-ta, the form of the function of equanimity in all of this. So here we go. So the jhanic factors. So there are five jhanic factors. Two of them we put in place. We have a more active role in putting them in place. And the other three we nurture, but they arise on their own. We don't do them. They do us. Whenever the time is right, they arise. And by trying to push and kind of squeeze more out of the three, actually the practice can falter. So what are the five? So the first one in Pali is vitakka, is known as vitakka. Vitakka translated as initial application, translated as aim, but aim, the lexical context is a little militaristic for my taste. I like connect. So connecting with the object, turning the mind to connect with the object, connect. So that is something that we do. We connect with the object. When the mind has fallen off the object. I love this morning in the guided meditation when Gil said, if your mind has slid off, slide back onto the breath. Oh, it's that reconnecting. You slide back on, you reconnect. So we've been giving you these instructions without calling them that. You reconnect, vitakka. You keep connecting. And it's usually it's always actually in a pair. The second jhanic factor is vichara, spelled V-I-C-A-R-A. The C is said, spoken as vichara, as a ch, vichara. And that is translated as sustained application or sustain. So The brief way to refer to them is connect and sustain. Connect and sustain. And the simile that I like, there are various similes, but you can think of, and if this was a bowl, in some ways it is a bowl, was holding the bell. So if this is the mind, this is attention, awareness, and this is your object, whatever it might be, breath, body, whatever it is, you connect, then you sustain. You sustain. The sustain is continue to rub the bowl, polish the bowl, rub the bowl, and then at some point it might fall off. Ah, no problem. You connect again. And at first, the periods of connecting and sustaining, the sustaining might be pretty short. The mind might fall off pretty quickly. You might have noticed the first day or two of the retreat, you were connecting, the mind was just gone. And then, you connect again, you would sustain for a little while, gone. But then after a while, actually, the mind gets connected with its object and hangs in there. It's longer sustaining. Sustained for much longer, polishes the object for a much longer period. And then it might slide off, and you gently connect again. So these two first jhanic factors we put in place. Connect, sustain. Initial application, sustained application. Vitaka vichara, vitaka vichara, vitaka vichara. We keep doing it. Vitaka vichara. And as we do the vitaka vichara with the other supportive conditions, with a relaxed mind that is not graspy, isn't wanting, isn't needing, isn't tight, the right amount of energy, then, in fact, I came up with a sentence to put these supportive structures, that I've come up with through my practice. The various supportive structure attitude is one of them. Being relaxed, receiving, an attitude of receiving, enjoying, really taking delight in the practice. Especially it's very important with samatha practice. Seclusion of the mind, renunciation of the mind becomes very important. Letting go, surrendering, trusting. Not being attached to the outcome, which is so very important, just doing the practice without attachment to the outcome. Sense of curiosity and interest in the process. And a gentle persistence. I love the word atapi. This persistent, gentle effort, gentle touch over and over again. And to summarize all these, the sentence that I came up with, establishing seclusion of mind, we relax and receive the joy of the present moment with a spacious attitude, trusting the process with interest while gently persisting. So putting these supporting structures in place while aiming and connecting and sustaining. I have such a habit of saying aim from many years ago and all the teachings I received, but I'm trying to change the terminology as best I can. Connecting and sustaining. And if the supportive structures are in place, relaxed attitude, not wanting, not grasping, not this, not all of that, then like a little birdie of grace, the other three factors might sit on our shoulders, but not expecting the birds. So the other three factors, just to mention them. So the third factor is the factor of piti, written in Pali, P-I-T-I, and it's translated differently, and it shows up on different lists. And this too, similar to equanimity, upekkha has kind of different functions and different ways it shows up on different lists. So piti can be translated as joy. It can also be translated as rapture. So in the practice, in the samatha practice, it can show up in different ways. It can show up with the feeling of delight, of happiness, of enjoying the object, or falling in love with your breath. The breath seems like the most wonderful, fascinating, lovely thing in the world. And in fact, it can feel really strange sometimes. Wait, I'm falling in love with my breath as if it's a person? Like, this doesn't make sense. But this is the sense of delight and joy, or could also feel as a bubbly, kind of a bubbly delight that shows up. It's just this bubbly happiness that shows up. Can also show up as rapture. And there are five different kinds of rapture. I won't go into them, but there are many different kinds of rapture, the way the energy of rapture energy can move through the body. I'll give a few examples. Sometimes when the mind starts to settle, it could feel like, oh, there are little bugs crawling up, and you look and, oh, there are no bugs crawling. It just kind of feels like some funny movement on the skin. Sometimes it can be just minor energetic movements that the body makes. Energy moving through, sometimes the limbs can move. Sometimes it's a feeling of bright explosion of bright light in the body. Sometimes it's waves of movement, energy. It can show up in so many different ways. And it can be very pleasant, and it can also feel unpleasant sometimes. It can have different vedana, different feeling tone to it. And sometimes at first when it shows up for meditators, it's like, wow, fun, awesome, I want more of this. Kind of falling into the trap of spiritual goodies. And so many experiences, they come and they go, and you know, by attaching to it actually and turning them. So when any of these come up in practice, one does not turn the mind to them. Just kind of notice that, oh yeah, there's rapturous energy, there's PT coming and going. Okay, great. You can enjoy it, but not be attached to it and not turn the mind to it. The mind stays on the object. The mind stays on the object. And these coming, the rapturous energy can come and go. And actually at some points it can feel like too much. It's too coarse. It's just too much. It's enough already. And some of you might be going, huh? Believe me, it's not where it's at. It's, yeah, it's fun and games. Yeah. But it's not, when it can even out into the next factor. The next factor, the fourth factor, is sukha, which can be S-U-K-H-A, which can be translated as bliss or happiness. And if we think of rapture or piti as this waves of, you know, joy, bubbly, kind of active, bliss, sukha seems to be more even, like, throughout the body. And it can, and as it evens out, especially as piti evens out to sukha, and sukha gets bigger and bigger and really mature. I mean, these all need to really, really mature for the jhanas to arise. So the maturing of the sukha can feel like complete pervading bliss. It's said in the suttas that it feels like it pervades every cell, every inch of the body. It doesn't leave anything untouched. And at some point, actually, the mind can get so calm and steady that feels like too much. It's just too much. It's not pleasant anymore. So hang in there with me. I'll explain more. So let me explain what the fifth factor is. So the fifth factor is ekagata, E-K-A-G-G-A-T-A. And it's translated often as one-pointedness, but I don't quite like that translation, I have to say. It gives rise to... I'll tell you what many practitioners experience this one like. It's a sense that the mind, the awareness, attention, is like nailed to the object. It cannot move. Even if it wants to, it's just like it's nailed there. Or a sense of magnet. There is a magnet as if the breath, the attention is just cannot move. It's just there. And it's not unpleasant. It's just a feeling of steadiness. It's the mind is so steady. It's just like glued to the object. There is such a level of steadiness. Okay. So, all right. So let me define the states of absorption according to these five, and you'll see how equanimity comes in a moment. We're getting there. This talk is a practice in patience and equanimity. Testing you. So at some point on the path of practice, and this might have also come up for you, you might have, as you've been doing also in this practice, even though it's not a samatha retreat, but with aiming and sustaining and the stability of the mind that comes up, the especially a little bit of piti and sukha can come up, the third and the fourth factors, kind of like pleasure, like, oh, delight in practice, the sense of bliss, they can come up and they can be very nourishing. So if they come up for you, please enjoy them. Don't get attached to them the same way that, you hold, if I was holding this object, the striker, with a fist, it would hurt. It's not pleasant anymore. And when it's gone, I want it. Where did it go? I want more. Whereas if it comes, pleasant, lovely. This is such a lovely striker. Look at this beautiful color. Nice. Oh, and then it's gone. Okay, I'll just continue doing my practice. It actually makes it more likely that these little birdies of grace will visit you. So as these, and especially when one is practicing samatha, unification of mind primarily, continuously, at some point these factors, the first two factors, vitaka and vichara, intentional, and then the other three factors will arise on their own, and they need to get mature. Really, and there are ways to work with them, instructions given, individually, usually by the teacher, one-on-one, how to work with them, how to mature them. And when they're all present and mature, there is this sense of being in upachara samadhi. It's not an absorption yet. It's when all the factors are present, all the five factors are present, and the mind is really stable. And bright, undistracted, the hindrances are at bay, just feels pretty even. It's like, oh, this is great. I'm enlightened, by the way, not, because with all these samatha states, the hindrances are momentarily at bay. They go away, but when the state goes away, the hindrances all come rushing back, which is why in this tradition, samatha is a precursor. Samatha practice is a precursor to vipassana. In fact, I'll tell a little story. So when the Buddha was studying, the story goes that he studied with all the masters of his time that were jhana masters, and he mastered all the jhanas. And they said, and his teachers told him, "This is it. You're awakened. You know the jhanas. You can just hang out in the jhana for as long as you wish." And he said, "No, this is not it. Because when I'm out of the jhanas, I see the greed, hatred, and delusions just hanging out. Hi, we're here waiting for you." So then he came up with the practice of vipassana, seeing the three characteristics of impermanence, not self, and unsatisfactoriness, which is yet another talk. But seeing vipassana, that is really the way to uproot these three, that really brings freedom in daily life, to see things in a completely different way, not just because we're powered, the battery powered by these bliss states, but really, even if you haven't practiced for a few days, still, they've been uprooted. They're not there. It's not dependent on these conditions anymore. So coming back to upachara samadhi, to access concentration. So in that state, all of these five are present. And then there are instructions are given in various ways to enter the first jhana. So the first jhana has all the five factors that I mentioned: vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata. They're all five present, but it's an absorption into, it's a different state of mind, and the mind can really see, whoop, it's a different way of, it enters into the jhana, into the state of absorption. And in the first state of jhana, especially vitaka and vichara are particularly prominent. I mean, all of them are there, but there's some effort, some engagement of connecting and sustaining to keep the first jhana going. Entering into the second jhana, which is deeper than the first jhana, the first two factors drop. So there is no intentional vitaka vichara, no intentional connecting and sustaining. The mind kind of is riding smoothly, and the three factors present are piti, rapture, sukha, bliss, and ekagata, one point in this. And the prominent one, the prominent factor in the second jhana is rapture. There can be a lot of rapture, a lot of bubbly joy, which can sound like great, but actually it can feel after some point when the mind is very, very subtle, the mind gets more and more subtle through these states of jhana, moving up. And at some point the mind can either do this on its own or instructions are given specifically, and the mind can enter the third jhana, where the third factor drops, piti, this effervescent joy, rapture, it drops. And the only two factors present in the third jhana is bliss, sukha, and the fifth jhanic factor, ekagata, one-pointedness, this mind being really, really stable. And the experience of the fourth jhana, there's a lot of bliss and the third jhana, and many people actually feel most quote unquote attracted or addicted if they do have the tendency to get kind of blissed out and addicted to these states, which is not helpful at all. It's, in my opinion, my humble opinion, it's not so different from getting addicted to drugs and just checking out, because at some point it just becomes non-productive to just do them for their own sake, not for the sake of waking up. So there's a lot of bliss. Sukha is predominant. But then when the mind actually gets very subtle, that feels like too much. It's just this bliss that in our worldly lives, like, oh, bliss, it's like, it's too much. It's not refined enough for the state of mind. And the mind can enter the fourth jhana. Okay? The fourth jhana has two factors. You might be wondering, wait, she just said the third jhana has had two factors. The fourth jhana has two factors? Good. You've been listening, if you're wondering. So, what drops, bliss drops, ekagata stays, and then equanimity arises. Ta-ta! We've arrived at equanimity. So, equanimity is more... is predominant. So what's predominant in the fourth jhana is equanimity. The mind is completely stable and balanced, not even moved, not moved by bliss or the bubbly rapture, nothing. It's just so equanimous. And the mind is very stable. And the fourth jhana is a, how should I put it, is a happier, deeper, lovelier experience than the other two. So, and I say that to kind of jiggle your mind, especially for those who might feel attracted to the, oh, bliss and the joy of these jhanas. They sound so great, and they're so, I love them when I hang out there, huh? Or when I kind of like piti comes up. Because as the Buddha said, peace is the highest happiness. Peace is the highest happiness. And the fourth jhana has this evenness of peace, evenness of equanimity, evenness, completely even. And it's beautiful and profound, really deeply profound. So a part of actually intentionally like taking all this time to get to equanimity after talking about these rapture states of, you know, bliss and rapture and it feels good and it's this and that, is equanimity is better. The mind that has equanimity is the happiest state of all of these, all these, you know, fireworks and joy and pleasure and, you know, orgasmic pleasure, whatever it is. Just equanimity is so much better. So much better. So, and in Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, the equanimity of jhana is described as impartiality towards even the highest bliss. And it's such a satisfying impartiality. So and that factor of equanimity that shows up in the fourth jhana is predominant, the mind being very, very even, still, unperturbed, undisturbed, not moving forwards and backwards. It's the same jewel, is the very same jewel, same diamond, same jewel. We've been inviting you to practice with all week. There are so many different doors to the temple. There are many, many different doors to the temple. So, jhanas, fourth jhana, equanimity predominant. One way equanimity, this evenness of mind shows up. There are many other doors to the temple. So, as you've been practicing with equanimity as a factor of awakening, relating to it, the bow of the ship, sense of equanimity, of all these factors, evenly coming together, this evenness of mind gliding on the water. As we talked about equanimity in terms of the Brahma Viharas, may I be at peace with the comings and goings of things. May I accept things just as they are, invoking the same mind, different facets of the same jewel. This invocation of equanimity. So, Anne Murphy, a Buddhist scholar, I'd like to end with this. She says that according to the Shorter Elephant Footprint Sutta, Chulaha Tipa Dopama Sutta, the faculties of mindfulness and equanimity were most predominant in the Buddha's mind when he comprehended the three knowledges and became fully enlightened. So, we hear so much about mindfulness, about sati, to consider that when the Buddha became enlightened, equanimity was, in his mind, most predominant in his mind, equanimity and mindfulness together. Really point to, for us to appreciate the deeply profound and beautiful state of mind that has multiple facets in its application. Thank you for your kind interest and listening. May this have been of service.